Just after 9 o'clock on a sunny Saturday morning, it's June 15th. I'm Scott Simpson, and you are tuned into Maritime Morning Weekend Edition on News 88.9 in St. John, News 91.9 in Moncton, News 95.7 in Halifax. Thank you for giving up part of your weekend, or letting us into part of your weekend, sharing the weekend with us. There's only so much weekend to go around, and we're glad you're here with us for part of it. Coming up on today's show, families in which kids have a freshly diagnosed food allergy face unique challenges. A doctor will talk about that later this half hour. Don't have any change for the parking meter? Imagine being able to pay for your parking with your smartphone. That's what one entrepreneur is enabling a couple of cities in the Maritimes to do this summer as parts of pilot projects. We'll talk to him. War on tobacco is 50 years old now in Canada, a long slog for the government's official fight. We'll see how it's going. Team Nova Scotia brought home big honors from Skills Canada National Competition in Vancouver, British Columbia last weekend. We'll talk to a gold medal winner who actually used to work here. That's right, we had a super genius in our newsroom. How did we ever let him go? We won't ask him that part. We'll ask him more about how he won a gold medal at the skills competition and what on earth the skills competition is. Our weekly tech talker Matt Corkum knows exactly what that is because he was one of the judges last weekend. That's why he wasn't here. He's the one who tipped us off to this whole thing in the first place, so I think he'll have a few words about that. Plus, we'll talk about the new offerings from Apple. Open lines at 10:30 will take us toward Father's Day. If you have your dad still in your life, what are you doing for dad? If you're a dad, what do you want done for you? Or what do you want the opportunity to do yourself? Father's Day, what are your wishes? 10:30 will be the time for that. Call us at 405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255 when we get to that. We'll get cultured a bit more with Jeremy Webb from Off the Leash at 11. Those hilarious wiener dogs will be on at 11:15. I don't know how many wiener dogs we'll actually have. We'll have an organizer from Wienerpalooza, and we'll find out whether it's We'll figure out what you call the little wiener dogs. And we will finish with the Rataya Parsons case with a look at how the school board and some other organization served in their roles in the case of that teenager who said she was sexually assaulted and humiliated and ended up trying to kill herself and then died in hospital. A pair of authors from Ontario make some recommendations in a report released yesterday. We'll have one of those women on with us for an interview at 11:30. As always, if you need to find us, we're on Twitter at MMWeekend. I'm at Simpson957. There's email scott.simpson@rci.rogers.com, and our phone number is 405-6000 in Halifax or 1-877-801-8255. Now, speaking of Twitter, imagine if your Twitter account was out of your own hands in a way that emulated what it would be like to have Tourette's syndrome, which is a neurological disorder characterized by involuntary vocal and physical outbursts. It's widely misunderstood, and because of that, in part, it can be really hard to live with. To talk more about a campaign being launched now by the Tourette Syndrome Foundation, that organization's president, Kathy Wiley, joins us on the line. Good day, Kathy.
Good morning.
What is this? What are you asking people to do in this campaign?
This campaign is fairly straightforward. People that have a Twitter handle are being asked to surrender their handle for the day, where they can sign up at surrenderyoursay.com. And throughout the day on June 19th, in addition to the tweets that they would normally send, throughout the day there will be verbal ticks sent out by the system, and they won't know what's being tweeted or when it's going to be tweeted. So it'll emulate having the verbal ticks that often go along with Tourette syndrome.
Will, if I try to send tweets, will it send my tweets interrupted?
Your tweet will go out, but there could be one ahead or behind.
Okay.
Yeah, it won't interrupt the middle of your tweet, but you'll have the tweets alongside of it.
And what kind of reaction are you hoping to provoke with this?
It's an awareness campaign to get people to understand what it can be like as someone with Tourette syndrome to have these things happen where you have no control over it. Because the nature of the disorder is that the physical and the vocal tics that go along with it are random. They happen without the person wanting them to happen. And so the awareness of how this can feel is what we're looking to achieve.
Okay, well, we have a platform right here in this talk show to clear up some misconceptions and misunderstandings about this. So let's dive into that. I'm curious, are the people who have these tics, they're aware of them. I mean, they don't have control over them, but are they aware that they're going on?
Yes, oh, absolutely, they're aware. They have most people have a little bit of control in the way that they can hold them back for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But they're somewhat like having a buildup of an energy or a sneeze. You know, like you can hold it back sometimes, but after you hold it back, it still has to come out. So the control is limited on what you can do with a tick. So people are aware they have them. You know, they know what they are, and I say to some degree they can restrain them for a little bit of time, but they'll eventually express the tick.
Is there any consistency among people who have this?
No, every case is unique. People have different ticks. They wax and wane over time. So a tick that somebody may have this year, next year, when you talk to them again, that may be completely gone, replaced by a different type of tick. So if somebody is, say, shrugging their shoulders and making like a sniffing noise right now,
sure,
as their ticks, a couple months from now, those might be completely gone, and instead they're blinking their eyes and maybe saying some words.
Does science have any understanding about how that works?
It's still not fully understood. It's definitely a neurological disorder. It is genetic. They've identified one of the genes that they believe is involved with it, but it's still a bit of a mystery. There's no specific test, you know, where you can take a blood test or anything like that and say, oh, okay, you have Tourette's syndrome.
So when you say it is genetic, if you don't have the gene, you don't have Tourette's?
Correct.
Oh.
Well, that's what they're assuming. Sorry, I should correct myself there. It's not fully understood.
Okay. So it then does run in families?
Yes. Yeah.
When does it usually first manifest itself?
Most often it shows up in children. The majority of children now are diagnosed at the age of 6 or 6 to 8, in that range. That has changed over the years. My son was diagnosed actually 20 years ago, and he was diagnosed at 6. But at that time, the diagnosis came around the age of 12 or 13, simply because it wasn't understood. So they still had the symptoms, but the doctors didn't recognize what it was. So that's changed.
Does the disorder look any different at 6 than it does at, say, 30?
Yes, it can. When youngsters start with it, they quite often start with just small tics with eyes blinking and a few facial movements, a bit of sounds, that type of thing. With some people, that stays the same, like they don't have anything that's more major than that. Well, with others, it can progress, and you can have larger tics, more bigger movements, more vocalizations, that type of thing. But a lot of people, by the time they reach the age of 18, their tics quiet down.
Oh, that was going to be my next question. Is this, do people, for lack of a better term, outgrow it?
Yeah, there's about a third of them may find that their tics pretty well go away, or that they don't really notice them any longer. Another third, they stay about the same, or they really aren't bothered by them. And about another third of the adults find that they're as bad, or in some cases worse.
Is there any real treatment for it? Today our society tends to turn to uphill, but I know there, in a lot of disorders, there are behavioral things that can be done to, if not cure, then at least help somebody adapt to their condition.
There are some medications that are out there, but the majority of the medications are actually targeted at other neurological areas that simply have a crossover, you know, where they will help the tics. More lately, there's some more cognitive behavioral therapies that are coming out that are proving quite effective.
Mm. Are these therapies easily accessed by people?
Not yet, no. In fact, the cognitive behavior therapy, or CBIT as it's called, is relatively new. There's very few people that are doing it in Canada yet. We're actually helping to address that at our conference in the fall. We're going to be having a session on for therapists and other people to train them on how to do CBIT.
Well, is this the same as the CBT that one would know from a lot of other psychological treatments?
Yes. Similar, it would be seen in obsessive-compulsive disorder and so on. Obsessive-compulsive disorder, ADHD, are strongly related with Tourette syndrome. A lot of people have one or both.
And a lot of those things tend to have anxiety components with them, too. Eh?
Exactly, yes.
Okay. Yeah, no, I know that the cognitive behavioral therapy is... Heck, I think most people would benefit from that. I think most people in any capacity, whether they're diagnosed with anything or not, could do with a good dose of cognitive behavioral therapy. Looking at your thoughts, looking at your reactions to them, being better able to recognize how you're thinking, how you're reacting, and managing your own stress through that. I think all of us could do with a bit of that.
I think I have to agree with that.
Heck, I would push for that to be taught in schools. I'm sure there's somebody who'd say, keep your psychs out of my schools. But, man, so many things that disorders, I'm not saying we can prevent a genetic disorder, but, hey, if everybody had the tools to be better, more mindful of their own thoughts and how they're reacting to the things around them and just more responsible for their own reactions to things. Tourette's, anxiety, ADHD, or just plain work stress, all that could benefit everybody. Anyway, that's my little soapbox piece for the day. So how can people sign up for this really interesting program, this awareness campaign, which launches next week?
They can go to www.surrenderyoursay.com, and all the information is there. They simply have to give their Twitter handle. They don't give up their password. We're not taking any personal information with it. And then starting at 9 a.m. on the 19th, you'll start having tweets go out with the ticks.
And I'm guessing that the people will inevitably see some unusual, odd tweets coming from people, and folks will say, dude, have you been hacked or something? And
Then you
will be in the position of saying, no, I've given up my account for Tourette's awareness.
Yeah, and the tweet will have the hashtag #SurrenderYourSay in it, so that, and a link to go to, so that it's not completely sitting there by itself with somebody going, hey, you've been hacked.
What a neat idea. And an ad agency came up with this.
Yeah, Saatchi & Saatchi. They were the creative people behind this, have done a great job. They're also behind our At Random project we had 2 years ago.
What was that?
It's a series of videos of people with Tourette syndrome that has been put up on a website called At Random, atrandom.com. And it is also similar to dealing with the disorder. When you go to the website, you see a different version of the website every time. The videos come up in a different order.
I am going to tweet a link to the Surrender Your Say video here. I'm going to tweet it from MM Weekend and Simpson 95.7. If you click on that, you can see a little promo for this thing and get hooked up with that. That's really interesting stuff. Thanks for sharing all that information with us, Kathy.
Well, thank you very much.
Have a great weekend, and I hope you can keep pushing for more information to get out about this and make more people aware.
Great. Thanks so much.
See ya. That's Kathy Wiley, president of the Tourette Syndrome Foundation of Canada. Coming up in just a few minutes, we were talking about anxiety there and its role in some disorders such as Tourette Syndrome and ADHD. Another thing that just makes people plainly anxious, not because they have a disorder, but someone in their family does, is food allergies. If your kid suddenly had a first episode of a food allergy, imagine how you'd feel. Well, you don't have to just imagine anymore. It's been studied. We'll talk to the author of a study on that next on Maritime Morning. Raising a child is an anxiety-provoking venture, but especially so when things go wrong, when a child gets sick. And a new research study has looked at the underlying causes of anxiety and uncertainty faced by parents and caregivers of children newly diagnosed with food allergy. Let's talk to the lead author, Dr. Zainab Abdulrahman. Did I say your name right at all?
Yes, that was actually quite good, Scott.
Well, thank you. It's a challenge. Parents want the best for their kids, of course, and we would assume that in an event like a newly emerging food allergy, parents would focus all their attention on the child. But you have looked at the parents and caregivers. What did you find about how they react at first?
Well, what we found was there was a lot of anxiety that was encountered when they had this first reaction. Understandably, the reaction itself is scary, but then also the steps after that, encounters with healthcare providers and trying to get information. The biggest part that we found was that there was a lot of anxiety around getting information after that first presentation. So we were seeing that patients and their families and the caregivers were very anxious, feeling like they weren't comfortable with how to recognize symptoms or how to manage their children if they had a reaction. Coupled with this, they were having such long wait times to see the specialist. So this was all reflected within the study, and it's something that, as allergists, you see that when you do meet these families later, but we wanted to formally study this and show everyone else who's involved in the care of these children.
That just seems almost obvious that they would be anxious. Is there anything that surprised you about the quality or the origin of this anxiety?
Yes, actually, it's natural to be anxious with any medical diagnosis, but some of the things that we saw were what we would consider even more extreme. For example, we were seeing that 84% of our family said they were avoiding eating out at restaurants. 61% said they would restrict their children's activity with other children. So we're seeing really big changes in life. We had 11% of our caregivers who quit their job in response to the diagnosis so they could be there at lunchtime, provide all the food. So this, we felt, was a reflection of the high level of anxiety and their feelings of lack of education and lack of control of management, that they were making such great changes in their social lives. And you can imagine this would impact the child, the family, the whole structure, really.
As somebody who's lived with someone who has had to have food restrictions, I can understand that avoiding eating out at restaurants kind of thing. As much as you think you might know about what you're feeding your child, you just have that sense that, I don't know, I'm just not convinced. I just don't trust I didn't make it myself. I can't see what they're doing in the kitchen. I don't trust that the people back there know how to read the labels.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is also, we're hoping that this will also reflect to our partners in the food care industry as well, so that they're aware of the anxiety our patients are going through, and so that they can also look at ways to address this. And there's other studies that are going on looking at interacting with the food care industry to see other ways we can make it safer for our families to be able to go to restaurants.
Well, more than ever now, we're seeing menus even saying that if you have something beyond saying if you have a food allergy, talk to your server. But we're seeing more stuff about people with gluten sensitivities or soy sensitivities or nuts, tree nuts, that kind of thing. More and more on restaurant menus. Is that the direction that is going to make parents more anxious or assuage their anxiety a bit?
I think that from our parents, what we got was that they felt other people didn't have a lot of education or didn't get the experience that they felt other people knew a lot about food allergies. So
sure.
Hopefully by having some of these labels, they will feel a little bit more comforted knowing that at least the restaurant is aware, or whoever they're talking to is aware about food allergies and
sure.
Knows a little bit about it.
Yeah, somebody in the corporation has taken some consideration of this. I don't expect every single server at every restaurant to be a food allergy expert. That's a lot to ask, but at least if I go to Boston Pizza and I know that somebody at corporate headquarters has gone through the menu and highlighted things that may kill my child, that might make me more likely to go there again. To quit a job in response to diagnosis, that's pretty extreme.
Exactly. And this was a direct reflection of how extreme the anxiety is. You expect a little bit of anxiety, just like with anything, but the fact that we saw such extreme responses, like quitting their job, 13% actually reduced their work hours as well. And when we talked to the families in the second part of the study, a lot of them talked about wanting to have more control over, the school lunches or even the family, extended family get-togethers, only being at their home. So there's a lot of wanting to exert control because they felt such anxiety about this.
Doctor, did you find any unrealistic anxiety, anything that people were afraid of beyond what the facts might have dictated?
Well, in terms of I don't know how to say for beyond, but definitely we thought some of the numbers were even higher than we would have expected.
Mm-hmm.
Like the restricting children's activity with other children, 61%. And, this isn't necessarily always food-related activities, but they said generally they've just reduced activities with other children. Or they've also talked about reducing time with extended family for fear that other family members might feed their child. So these are, some of them are expected to hear, but some of the numbers were quite high. And, this, it really impacts the development of a child to have interaction with other children, with their extended family. So it's more prompted us more as a call to action, just how high some of these numbers were. And then frankly, for 11% quitting their job in response to their diagnosis
yeah.
is huge.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Often when I talk to researchers, their conclusion is more research is needed. Is more research needed?
I think that we have good information. We surveyed across the nation. We got good response rates. And the bottom line is families need timely and reliable access to accurate and trustworthy information. And our partner, Anaphylaxis Canada, has actually responded to the survey in terms of action. So they've created an allergy support center, which has a lot of information to help better equip our families. So at this point, from the study, we're actually looking at more action items. So there's the allergy support center, but we're also going to be working, hopefully, with all the other healthcare providers to help provide further education and how to provide frontline resources and referring parents to online resources as well as the handouts that are available, but just to get them into the right locations. So I guess there's always further research in terms of other aspects of food allergy, but I think to respond to this, there's a lot of action items we have that are on the table at this point.
Always good to see action beyond just knowledge. Mm-hmm. Doctor, thanks so much for writing this report, and we'll spread the word.
Thank you so much for having me.
Have a safe weekend and watch what you eat.
Thank you, I will. And if I could just say one thing to to all the families out there who have been touched by food allergy, I want you all to know that food allergy is a serious condition, but it can be managed safely, and there are resources out there to help equip your families. I encourage you all, whether you're newly diagnosed or if you have a previous diagnosis, to look at the Allergy Support Center. It has information that is helpful for anyone at any stage with food allergy.
And you can find that online at allergysupportcenter.ca.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, doctor. That's Dr. Zainab Abdulrahman, who is the co-author, one of the authors of this report on the anxiety facing families and caregivers of children who are newly diagnosed with food allergies. Time for a news break, and then we will be back with the CEO and president of an outfit that is equipping a couple of maritime cities with parking meters that you can pay with your smartphone. Next on Maritime Morning. 9:32 on a gorgeous sunny Saturday morning in the Maritimes. Saturday, June 15th. Halfway through the month. It feels like summer's almost here. Literally, it is almost here. What, it's 6 days away? 7 days away? Math is not my strong suit. I think it usually starts around the 21st, and then the days start getting shorter, right? We're just getting used to the days getting longer. Anyway, on a positive note, let's say you're lucky enough to find a parking spot downtown, okay? Imagine this. Now you have to find some coins for the meter. And you're looking through your pocket, and all you find is your phone. Aha, that might be enough to pay for the parking meter. No, you don't pawn your phone to the nearest guy walking by just for some spare change. Imagine being able to use your phone to pay the parking. Let's talk to Philip Curley, CEO and founder of Hotspot Parking. Hello, Philip.
Hi, how you doing today?
I'm groovy. How are you?
Oh, I'm great.
In the most basic terms, what system are you implementing here? How does this work?
Basically, with our pilot project we're doing with Fredericton, we're going to have users sign up and make an account with Hotspot. Then we'll put stickers on every one of the meters with specific numbers. So when you arrive downtown, you'll call 1-800-HOTSPOT. Enter your meter number, and that will bill you for your parking time.
Okay, go over that one more time. So you walk up to a parking meter. There's a sticker on it. It has a toll-free number. You call the number on your phone. You call the number?
Yep, you'll call 1-800-HOTSPOT, and then you'll enter your meter number. That will assign you a rate and a maximum time length you're allowed to stay there based off the law limit. And then you can pay for however long you'd like to stay to park. Great thing is, if you're inside and you realize you're going to be in a meeting a little bit longer than you thought,
We'll
actually send you a text message saying, hey, would you like to top up your meter? And you'll have the option to top up your meter from inside.
You can plug the meter without getting out of your chair.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, that's great. But, okay, so the meter maid comes by, sees Buddy sitting there with his Toyota at a meter. How does the ticket giver know that this meter's paid for?
Absolutely. The commissioners are all going to have handheld devices. In some cities, they currently have these. In other cities, we're going to provide them with handheld devices that basically state which meters have been paid for through our system.
Oh, so they'll walk down the street and it will be reflected on their screen which of these meters are in a paid condition and which ones are not paid.
Exactly.
Oh, that's so cool. That's so cool. Now, how there? I could imagine half a dozen different ways of paying with your smartphone. What that might look like. One, you know, you tap somehow. You tap the meter with your phone, or you wave it, or you scan a barcode, or there's an app or something. How did you come up? How did you settle on this idea of dialing a number and typing something in?
What this does with the call in service, we're also going to make it so you can text, but this allows anybody's phone to do it. It doesn't have to be a smartphone, so you can have an old-fashioned flip phone and still be able to do this.
Oh, because there are more people than we think with old-fashioned phones.
Absolutely. Eventually, we're going to move into a mobile application once we've tested it to make it very simple for people using smartphones. So there will be QR codes, there will be NFC at some point, and it's just right now to test out the product and make sure it works.
How big of a test bed are you setting up?
We're setting up in Fredericton. We're going to try to launch in August 1st and St. John's somewhere around that time frame.
That sounds like when you're dealing with city governments, things don't move that quickly. What's the timeline been on working on all this?
Absolutely. With Fredericton, we already have approval from the parking services to do the pilot. We're working on getting in front of council now. With St. John, they work a little bit differently. We have approval from the council, and now we're talking with the parking services.
Wow.
But basically, these two cities have been very progressive and are really looking for a solution to help their residents.
You are not part of the old-fashioned establishment parking authority system or parking provider system. You're kind of a new kid on the block, aren't you?
Yeah, a little bit, actually.
Clue people in. How old are you?
21.
You're 21 year old and you're setting up the future of parking.
Well, we're just trying to bring it to the 21st century for everyone. It's available in a lot bigger cities, but we think we have a neat little way to do it for smaller cities. So we're going to try to set it up here.
Well, is this scalable to how big a city then?
The great thing is it's scalable to any size municipality. But what's really important is it also works for smaller municipalities. Where a place like Toronto would obviously have this system. A place like Halifax doesn't right now because it's not a million people city.
Well, I could imagine. Yeah, you've got to find some kind of solution that is affordable for a smaller outfit. Because somebody, a town like St. John or Fredericton or Moncton or even Halifax is not going to buy the same kind of technology that the city of Toronto or Vancouver or Montreal is going to buy. They're going to either develop something in-house or buy a huge off-the-shelf solution.
Exactly. And that's why we've actually come up with a unique way to set this up for free with every city that we are partnering with.
Free? Tell me more.
Well, what we're going to do at some point down the road is we're going to apply some sort of surcharge to the driver. So if they wish to use our system, the way that we've been looking at it now for Fredericton is for our pilot project, everything will be for cost. But at some point in the future, we'll try to charge a 20% user fee. So if you pay for a dollar's worth of parking downtown, it would be $1.20.
That seems backwards to me. I'd want a discount because I'm saving the city the trouble of having a guy walk around with a little trolley collecting coins and rolling the coins and bringing the coins to the bank. The fact that it's all electronic, I'm saving the city money. I should get a discount.
We look at it that way too, but we also look at the convenience factor. So the idea that with our system, you're going to know how much time you have on the meters. We're going to be actually texting you and asking you to top up. We're hoping that through this convenience factor and the idea that what you're really buying is you're buying the security of not getting a ticket. So
okay.
We're hoping that the 20% is reasonable.
Okay. I can see you selling it on that. It's sort of a premium service. You're getting more than just a parking space. You're getting parking service on top of that.
For sure. But we're always looking for user feedback. If we realize that the fee is a little too much, we're going to see what we can do to work around that.
So how are you going to make money off this? I mean, are you charging a licensing fee to use this, a subscription, a service fee, maybe, just a little off the top?
Right now, we're just applying our premium model and seeing how that works out for smaller cities.
Yeah?
Yeah, and that's kind of where we are at with it. We have a little bit of a large-scale vision, which I won't get into too much, but at some point, we think we have a unique little way to make it work a little bit better with the city.
Well, I don't want you giving away your whole business plan, because at 21, I'm sure there's a guy who's got twice as much experience out there who'd love to scoop your idea and just roll it out.
Oh, and twice as much money, for sure.
Well, yeah. How are you able to do this? Do you have some kind of angel investor behind you pushing this along? What?
Yeah, we have a few angel investors here from the Atlantic region, and just a lot of really good people have come on board with the startup community that's building here, especially in New Brunswick. A lot of great connections through the cities, through software developers, municipalities, local government. Everybody's really come together and said, this is something they want to see, and this is something we're working forward together on.
What's been the biggest challenge in this?
The biggest challenge in this? I would have to say right now it's just explaining to everyone how the system's going to work, trying to make them most aware. And so whenever we roll out in August, it's not a huge surprise, because we're very excited to show everybody, but we don't want to have that initial shock. What is this pay-by-phone service?
Yeah, well, exactly. So this is to complement the existing system, right? This is not to replace the old coin meters.
Absolutely. It's just another option.
So it's the big challenges has not been the technical side. You guys can make that stuff work in your sleep, I suppose. It's getting humans to understand it.
Yeah, for sure. We have a couple of unique partners too. A couple of different consulting engineers just helping us on the side. Software companies that are very ingrained in the system in the municipalities already working with us.
Are there people within the city who? You know, I was just feel free to say that you don't want to answer this, because I
yeah for sure.
Are there people within the city who are getting in your way on this?
Are getting in the way?
Yeah, I mean, one would think that a city would come along and you come along to a city and offer them a solution like this, and the city would go, wow, we couldn't do this ourselves. Heck yeah, let's jump on board. But I would also guess that there's some people who are like, we like our coins. Get out of our way, boy.
Absolutely. In terms of people that have been getting in our way, we've actually honestly had no issues, because with our system through different pay-by-phone systems in bigger cities, it's actually been shown to increase revenue in larger cities, but it's just the volume in larger cities is why different companies go there. So with our smaller solution, we're hoping that we're going to have a similar effect where we end up increasing revenue, but just for a smaller municipality. So we've actually had no backlash from it.
So this is a pilot project. When are you going to know whether it is a winner that's going to keep going?
Absolutely. We're going to be doing weekly reviews with a lot of different people, so their users hopefully are going to be able to do that. And then after a six-week period, we're going to put out a big survey with all the retailers in the area, all the drivers in the area, the municipalities, everybody that's actually involved in the parking situation, and ask them how they felt about it, what they would like to see improved moving forward, and then at some point present our findings probably to council and actually get approval to continue.
Cities are not the only people who have parking. There are private businesses that have parking on their property too, who want to control their parking spots. We like to think that we have a lot of owners, managers, and professionals listening to this very radio station. A shout out to them if they're interested in your product. Should they bother contacting you? Is this a system that could be tailored to a private operation?
Ideally, yeah. Our real end goal is that we want to make it so that there's one simple solution for the entire Atlantic Canada, so that you don't have to go to Fredericton and download a new app. You don't have to go to St. John's and download a new app. We want to make one solution for every parking situation and just make sure that the money is all flowing in the right directions. So as we move forward into parking lots and parking garages, that is what we're hoping to accomplish after our pilot period. Right now, we're dealing with the biggest problem, which is parking meters.
Yeah, parking meters. Bleh.
I know.
Yeah, people. You could set up almost any space as a parking meter. All you got to do is put up a sticker now, and say, pay for this space by calling this number and typing in a code. You don't have to install a parking meter and have somebody come by and service it. It's a sticker, a sign.
Yeah, this is the reality of, I guess, the world we live in, where a lot of people are looking at it like this. But the problem is there's always individuals that have coins, want to pay with coins, will always want to pay with coins.
Yeah.
So I doubt we'll see parking meters actually disappear anytime soon.
That's fine. A complimentary technology.
Absolutely.
And if you can get, a dime or two off every hour somebody's paying for, hey, those dimes add up, and you could become a very rich man, sir.
Hopefully. I had a dime for everybody that uses the system. I'll let you know.
Homegrown solutions. All right. Where can people find you online for more on this?
Hotspotparking.ca, because we're a Canadian company.
Hotspotparking.ca. Watch for it coming this summer in Fredericton and hopefully St. John. Thanks for joining us, man.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you very much, Scott.
Philip Curley is the president and CEO of Hotspot Parking, developing a new solution for small cities to manage their parking meter solutions with smartphones. Really cool. It's been a long time since Canada started fighting tobacco. Have we won yet? Are we still fighting? What have we learned? We'll reflect on this after this break on Maritime Morning. 9:48 a.m. I miss smoking. I quit last August, but I still want a cigarette. Just a quick confession that should illustrate the evil power of tobacco. Canada's been fighting smoking for half a century. As of Monday. To look back in the battle, we're joined by Kelly Wilson, Manager of Government and Community Relations for the Canadian Cancer Society. Good day, Kelly, and I apologize for admitting that I miss it.
It's all good.
But it's true! It's true! I had a cigarette a week ago at somebody's birthday party, and it tasted just gross. I don't know how I did that, you know, 10 times a day before.
I agree. Agreed.
So what happened 50 years ago that got us started?
Sure. So Monday is a really important day for us at the Canadian Cancer Society and all of our partners in tobacco control. It is the 50th anniversary of a very important statement that was made by the then Minister of National Health and Welfare, Judy LaMarche. So on that day in 1963, the minister acknowledged that smoking causes lung cancer.
Huh. Straight out, she said it like that.
Straight out. And at the time, I mean, that's something that's fairly common knowledge now, but at the time it was quite a controversial statement and it was heavily refuted. And I think here in Canada, we should be really, really proud of this because the statement was actually made about 7 months before the U.S. Surgeon General made a similar announcement. So we were really a pioneer in this respect.
Now, Minister LaMarche was a politician. What was she basing that on at the time?
By the evidence that was being compiled at the time, different scientific evidence, and like I was saying, it was quite heavily refuted by the tobacco industry. So mm-hmm. there was a lot of sort of backing and forthing, until we came to a place, of course, now and in very recent history that the evidence was there.
Now, back at that time, you had people, and I'm thinking of one person in particular. Who would say dumb things like smoking doesn't cause cancer, not smoking enough causes cancer? You had people who were saying things that in scientific hindsight were just ridiculous.
Absolutely. The tobacco industry was and continues to be very, very aggressive in their advocacy towards finding, keeping their existing smokers and finding new smokers. So back in that point in time, in 1963, about 50% of all Canadians were smokers, which is a huge number of people that were addicted to tobacco. And, now we've come to a place where that number is much, much lower at 18.1% here in Nova Scotia. But, this addiction was very commonplace and has had a huge impact on our society.
If you've ever watched the show Mad Men, and as an ex-smoker, I got to say watching Mad Men is hard because they're smoking all the time. And I'm sure it's not an accident, though they're trying to create a scenario that is so different from today. But it doesn't seem unbelievable that people were smoking in airplanes, restaurants, schools, hospitals, doctor's offices. So I guess change was slow to come. I mean, it's one thing to have a politician say, there may be a link between cigarette smoking and chronic bronchitis and eventually smoking bans. Where did we start seeing the actual changes happening?
Definitely. I think pretty much every generation now can think back to, a decade ago or 2 decades ago or 3 decades ago and how different the world was in the area of tobacco. Really, it was a slow start getting, after the statement was made, getting this ball moving and, that being the catalyst for all of this change. I think that there's a couple of areas that we can really point to in Canada where we've been pioneers in this area. So Canada was the first country to ban smoking on domestic air flights, and that was back in 1987. And about 6 years after that, followed international flights on domestic airlines. So these were huge, you know, even though it kind of seems silly to think about it now, about that being a reality, these were huge steps forward, and Canada really was out there making this change happen. Calgary was also the first city in the world to have a host of smoke-free Olympics back in 1988. And again, a very, very controversial step forward that Canada can be proud of.
It does seem hard to wrap our minds around the fact that as recently as 87, you could smoke on a Canadian domestic air flight or an international flight of a domestic airline in 1994. That, to me, that I know that's almost 20 years ago, but it just feels like yesterday.
It does feel like yesterday. It really, really wasn't that long ago. And I think that's, you know, over the last 50 years, we've made such huge progress. I think here in this province, especially as well, just over about 12 years ago, I would say our smoking rates were around 30% right across this province. And so we've seen that drop down to, you know, where we are now at 18.1%. That's having a significantly huge impact on, you know, preventable disease and preventable tobacco-related illness in this province. And we need to continue this work so that number drops at an even faster pace.
And some of the weapons we've used in this so-called war, taxes. Taxes have been pointed at again and again as a huge factor in decreasing the smoking rate. Is that our biggest policy weapon?
You know, there's definitely no magic bullet in this area. I think that's one of the biggest lessons that we've learned, particularly over the last decade. There's been a number of initiatives that I think have all contributed to the success that we've seen. Taxes are definitely a disincentive to smoking. That is proven through evidence over and over and over again. So that is an important component. But on the flip side, just as important is really developing programs and cessation tools and resources for people so that they can quit smoking. So that's an area where the Canadian Cancer Society is really proud to be involved in hosting services like the Smokers Helpline that provide resources to help people quit. But I mean, there are certainly lots of other initiatives. Those are really big ones. But you even look at the municipal level. Really, every government, every role, every level of government has a role to play in this. So Wolfville, for example, was the first municipality in Canada to ban smoking in cars with children. And that was something that happened very, very local in this province that is now provincial legislation in 8 different provinces across Canada. So, you know, small area in Nova Scotia can have a huge impact right across Canada.
Somebody has to be first. In the decades to come, I wish I'd written this question out because it's a good question. I just don't know how to ask it. What will society in the decades to come look back on and say, I can't believe they were still doing this in 2013 in terms of smoking?
One thing that the Canadian Cancer Society in Halifax or Nova Scotia is really actively working towards is smoke-free outdoor public spaces. And I think that this is, another important step forward. So we're working with municipalities right across the province to implement smoke-free outdoor spaces bylaws so that people in, all people, but particularly places where children play, like parks and playgrounds, recreation facilities, trails, hiking paths, that those places are all smoke-free so that we can go there, be outdoors, and enjoy recreation while not being exposed to secondhand smoke.
So you're hoping that, 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now, people will look back at 2013 and say, I can't believe people let other people smoke outside.
That's my hope. Well, not necessarily outside in general, as a sort of catch-all.
Yeah.
But I think in places where people are active, it's an important piece. But my bigger hope really is that 20, 30, 40 years from now, we're not looking at 144 Nova Scotians who are, who would report themselves as daily smokers. I hope that we're looking at numbers much, much smaller than that.
Yeah. If that, yeah. Do you think we'll ever stop smoking at all?
We can all dream. I hope so. I think we've made a huge amount of progress in the last decade, and I see no reason this continues to be an important issue. It continues to be on the Canadian Cancer Society's agenda, and it should be on all governments' agendas. And I hope that through a concentrated effort between all of those bodies, we can continue to move forward.
I appreciate what you do, and I hope you keep doing it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for being on the show today.
You're very welcome.
My pleasure. Kelly Wilson is a manager of government and community relations for the Canadian Cancer Society, talking with us about the 50th anniversary of the first volley launched in Canada's war on smoking. We'll talk to a gold medalist next on Maritime Morning.